Texas Talking Owl.
What was that you said?
Texas Talking Owl.
Gonna hoop upside your head.
Texas Talking
Owl. Tell me, who can you trust when Texas gods are
when Texas gods love Texas Talking?
Hello, and welcome to the TripCast. This is Carlos Sanchez, the editor of the Monitor newspaper in the beautiful city of Palms, McAllen, Texas, the current destination for thousands of Central American immigrants and for every member of Congress looking for a photo op. And now, here's your host, Reeve Hamilton.
Thank you. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the TripCast for the final week of July. I'm joined by executive editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
Reporter Nina Satija.
Hi.
And reporter Aman Bathija.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us. In the middle of summer. I know you all wish you were on vacation, but here we are, hard at work.
I am on vacation. I'm Skyping in from, you know, Belize or something.
I'm hoping nobody's listening to this while they're on vacation. That would spoil things.
It would.
You just made a bunch of people on vacation feel bad about themselves.
No, not really.
They probably already do.
They're the kind of people who vacation with their cell phones at hand.
Honestly, they've been drinking too much on their vacations anyway. You know who you are. Let's move on from vacation to... very serious situation on the border. Why don't we? We've talked about this for the last few weeks, but there's ongoing developments. And the latest is that Texas law enforcement officials indicated that they did not ask for or necessarily feel a need prior to Rick Perry's announcement that he was sending up to 1,000 National right. Guard troops down to the border.
The Department of Public Safety and the Texas National Guard both told a House committee in Austin that, you know, in fact, they had not asked the governor to strengthen their forces on the border. But they, you know, they both added that, you know, but we don't think it's a bad idea. And Steve McGraw, the head of the Department of Public Safety, said he thinks that the best measure of whether they're securing the border is going to be apprehensions and arrests. Apprehensions and arrests have been down for some time. They're at a 35-year low, the last numbers I looked at. But they're not zero, and he said zero is really the proper number. So, you know, they're going to continue with that. In the meantime, Perry was on a conference call, I guess, to New Hampshire Republicans and referred to it as a battlefield, which isn't making, you know, business people and economic development people on the border very happy. But that's kind of the political characterization of this thing right now.
Right. I will say that Perry has a sort of tendency towards battlefield metaphors. I remember he referred to all the, you know, conflict at UT Austin and the UT system in his emails to regents of the UT system as, you know, he compared it to the Battle of the Bulge and has used a lot of sort of militarized language there. So it might just be the way he describes things or the way he thinks of things.
Just his favorite metaphors. But it's, you know, for the – you know, there's two things going on the border. I mean, one of them is the thing we've all been talking about, but there's also a lot of business and commerce and stuff down there, and they're trying to do economic development and things. And some of those guys are tired of – some of those people are tired of being characterized as a war zone where businesses don't want to relocate. And so you see – I mean, it's not getting as much attention as the other things, but, you know, groups in El Paso and McAllen and Harlingen and some others saying, you know, hey, we're trying to sell this thing down here.
Especially because, I mean, from what I've read of reports down there, like you had the stuff Eric Benson wrote for Texas Monthly, it sounds very calm in the cities.
Right.
You know.
Well, and a lot of these people are coming across the border and instantly looking for the Border Patrol person and saying, I'm here, take me in.
Take me to the battlefield.
Right. Doesn't sound very dangerous.
Yeah. So, there's clearly a border problem and there's clearly a, you know, there's quite clearly a political issue here. But it's, you know, it's creating some dissonance for people that are just trying to live and work down there.
Well, and does the testimony that, you know, people that gives people ammunition to make the argument that this is more of a political move, a very expensive political move than a sound policy move, plus sort of these battlefield comments in New Hampshire, which is obviously a presidential related.
It's a battleground state. We're going to see a battlefield.
Yeah. I mean, you know, does that sort of open the door for the possibility that this could very seriously come back to bite Perry?
I don't know if it comes back and bites him. I mean, it's clearly an issue. It's clearly an issue where the conservatives and the Republicans have kind of coalesced around an idea that, you know, we ought to secure the border, that we ought to do more to keep people from coming over the border. And as a political matter, I think it's a pretty clear thing. It also answers the biggest defect in Perry's last presidential run, which was, you know, when he was talking about in-state tuition for the children of undocumented immigrants. The Texas law allows kids who've lived here for a certain number of years, who've also graduated from Texas high schools, to go to state universities and colleges and pay in-state tuition. And he found himself defending that and found it pretty unpopular with Republicans in other parts of the country when he was running for president. So a lot of the hard line that he's taking now, photographs of him sitting with a gun on a gunship at the border, those kinds of things probably help on the political optics.
Well, and also Congress is about to recess for 5 weeks. And if they don't put any money towards the border, Perry gets to say for the next month, I'm the only one who did anything.
And it was his idea. Nobody even told him to do it. They think
true.
It's a great idea, but he got to it first, right?
A man of action. And it seems to be working for him. I mean, his poll numbers appear to be moving in a positive direction.
Yeah, they're bumping up. So
I guess you can't argue with success. So that's our update on that situation, I guess. And might as well, since I mentioned the University of Texas system, give a little update over there for those people who have not been following yesterday's news.
It's not a battlefield, but they've gone. They've gone all military on us.
It is a battlefield, and that's why they brought in the commander of U.S. Special Operations Command, the Admiral William McRaven, who famously planned the attack on Osama bin Laden that was successful, will be the next UT system chancellor, which is sort of a big name and a big job. I guess if he can handle Osama bin Laden, he can probably handle the tension with the Board of Regents. But I think it caught a lot of people by surprise because obviously he doesn't have either background that you think of for a chancellor. Right? And most chancellors in Texas are either former politicians, usually former state politicians, or they are sort of former academic administrators. And he's neither of those things, but everyone seems pretty excited about it.
So the two big things in this job are, can you run a big political organization and a big non-political organization, and can you raise money?
Mm. Right? And can you get along with politicians?
Right.
Let's not forget that he was a journalism major, J-school grad. I mean, chops
so,
right
yeah.
there.
But that actually, another strike.
So not everything lines up right.
So not good with money is what you're saying. Right.
No, well, he
did they know that?
He cleverly sought other employment. So, you know, good
did he
him.
Ever do anything related to journalism, or did he just
he has had many profiles written about him.
There we go. He's interacted with lots of journalists.
Yeah, that's right. Which is a key part of the job.
Yes,
that actually
right.
sort of is an important part of the job. But I think the UT system. There's been a lot of talk about whether or not they'd be able to recruit for this position because
right.
they've had so much public strife over there.
Yeah, who would take a job like that, right?
Right. And I think it turns out lots of people, well, it's a very highly qualified people. But I think Perry early on, Governor Perry was pushing for Kyle Janik, who's the head of Health and Human Services here in Texas. That didn't go too far with the board, I think, because they didn't want to have someone too closely tied to the outgoing governor.
And he got his undergraduate degree at another institution that caused some consternation in Longhorn Nation.
But that's also true of Richard Fisher, who was the other – he came in second for the gig. He's the head of the Dallas Fed. And they also apparently – strongly considered Bob McDonald, who just got named Secretary of Veterans Affairs, former Procter & Gamble CEO. So, I mean, there were a lot of big names. Apparently they had 17 viable candidates. They whittled that down to 9. They got that down to 2, and then they went with McRaven. So that also bodes well for the president of UT Austin job. I mean, if they were getting that sort of level of interest in the UT system job, despite the strife, the UT Austin job, which is coming open in June 2015.
So how fast are they starting work on that president's job at the University of Texas at Austin now? I'm knowing that the current president's going to be there another year, or do they wait some time, or what's the story?
I think they can there's not a huge rush, but I think they'll start to work on it. I think they'll probably maybe see some announcements about search committees in the next months or so. Now that they've gotten this chancellor thing out of the way, they can focus on that.
Do the regents hire the president, or does the chancellor hire the president?
The regents hire the president, and the chancellors fire the president. Chancellor fires the president. So we'll see what happens. But UT Nation, you know, the university boosters and alumni that have been very, very critical of the board in recent years have been very sort of effusive in their praise of McRaven. I mean, it doesn't hurt that he gave one of the most popular commencement addresses
it's
the university has ever seen.
It's a great address. It's, you know.
Yeah, actually, I've been making my bed just because he told the students to.
So he's already done some good in the state of Texas.
Yeah, that was his first bit of advice was if you want to, you know, start changing the world by making your bed or something. I forget. He put it better. That's why he's chancellor and I'm not.
So are there many other chancellors of university systems who were formerly in the military? I don't, you know, is there precedent for this? Well, does that
there's,
make
there's
sense?
Some. Robert Gates was president at
he was
Texas
president
A&M.
Of Texas A&M. Okay. Janet Napolitano, I mean, you know, she was secretary of defense. She's over at the UC system.
Homeland Security.
Yes.
Thank you, Ross.
Yeah, blank.
Filling
yeah.
in too late.
Yeah, so, well.
Shouldn't have brought it up. Janet Napolitano is a chancellor or president or something over at UC. Their titles are switched in California. They call what we call chancellors presidents and vice versa. So she's one of those.
But at least they had worked in, like, government, you know, as opposed to like, you know, being a military commander. I don't know. It just seems different.
I think that's
working. Interesting.
I think that is working in government.
Yeah, but not in the same way. You're not. Yeah.
No, I've been getting a lot of sort of, you know, not on the record, but a lot of like, well, great, I get that he killed bin Laden, but, you know, what does he know about academics? And I really just think that if you look at the other chancellors and you look at this guy's record.
Well, he's running.
What does he really need to know? As long as he has an appreciation for academics.
He's running a big enterprise. It's like 67,000 employees, $10 billion a year. So he's done that. He knows, you know, how the organizational behavior. I mean, he's been in the armed services for 23 years. Help.
I think
maybe,
30, 37.
Maybe longer than that.
I think he's going to retire with 37 years.
He's been at that stuff for a long time. He's walking into a place where they need somebody to sort of lead. And, you know, he's got the experience for that.
And he did design his graduate school curriculum in low intensity conflict, something or other.
And we'll find out, you know, over the next two or three years whether they did the right thing or not.
That's true.
Well, and one weird note is just in April, TxDOT picked a new executive director, and his military background was the main selling point. He was, I have it up here, commander of U.S. Marine Corps Forces Command in Iraq. And so that's, I guess, is almost a trend now of Texas picking military people as leading. And that guy didn't have any, I mean, he doesn't have a lot of transportation experience, but he just kept saying, everyone who supported him was just saying, well, he knows how to run a big organization.
Right. And they've had to build some infrastructure over there after they blew it up.
So basically everything in Texas is a battlefield. If you take away nothing from this, you know, long podcast, take that away. But let's get back to politics for a bit, shall we? I guess, Aman, you wrote a story about the measurements on the political battlefield of Texas and how they're going to be more robust this time around, it sounds like.
Yes. In November, when people go to vote, I'm assuming everyone who listens to this podcast votes. When you walk out of...
Some of them twice.
When you walk out of the polling place, you might get someone asking you a bunch of questions about how you voted and background about, you know, your ethnicity, your religion, your income, your education. That is going to be an exit pollster who is... there's planning for thousands of them in Texas to get, you know, deep-level data of who voted and how they voted in Texas. Exit polling has been done around the country for decades, but in 2012, the main group that does it decided to do just bare bones exit polling in Texas to save money. So we reported last week that they are planning to ramp up their polling in Texas this year because of the interest in the state. So that should mean there's a lot more data to work with after the election to understand what happened.
So you'll know things like, you know, how Hispanics voted as opposed to just how many people voted for this candidate or that one, how women voted, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. And after 2012, there was a lot of debate over how well Ted Cruz did with Hispanics. And we basically never got a good answer because we didn't have the exit polling.
Did they just decide that Texas was not worth the investment?
Is
the polling industry hurting?
The group that does the exit polling now, they're called National Election Pool. It's a media consortium. It's made up of the Associated Press, CNN, Fox News, NBC News, and a few other TV news organizations. And they just said, we don't have enough money, so we need to kind of focus where we think they were basically focusing on where the presidential race was going to be.
The battleground states.
Yes.
I knew somebody was going to say it.
And so it was actually, I think, 18 or 19 states they decided we're going to do just bare bones polling, which will give us enough to kind of say in advance who won that state, but not enough for researchers to go in later and find out, you know, how many Hispanics voted for a Senate candidate or things like that.
And so is it mostly wonks that are excited by this? I mean, is there anything for the average Joe to get pumped about when it comes to more polling?
I think it's political junkies, but it's, you know, if you worked, people work on campaigns, work with the parties, they rely on this data to get a sense of, you know, were we close in this race? Did we have a, how'd we do with this group, and kind of figure out their plans for the future? And so I think they're really excited. And just there is this wide body of research going back decades based on this polling data. If you look up National Election Pool in like Google Scholar or something, you'll find hundreds of studies all based on this data. So
was 2012 the only blip when they sort of scaled back?
In recent memory, I asked people and they said, we can't remember a year where they didn't do like extensive polling in every state. So it was in recent memory, that was the first major one, yeah.
Well, and Texas has been one of the states where, you know, you could get really deep polling on different ethnic groups and different age groups. So you can find out, for example, whether Hispanics are not voting as much as Anglos, you know, as a because they're Hispanic, they've got a different culture, or is it because the Hispanic population is younger than the Anglo population and older people vote more than younger people? Things like that. I mean, getting inside the numbers and figuring out who's voting, who's not voting, how they are voting, it's useful to future campaigns.
And this will also perhaps be an interesting year to have that information, given the sort of unconventional tactics we're starting to see in the campaigns, right? You see Greg Abbott going up with his ads in movie theaters, and will this be able to give us a better sense of whether or not that works? We just transitioned into your other story.
That may be your best segue ever.
Until you guys started talking about the segue.
It's good to have a feedback loop.
Yes, there are a lot of unusual campaign tactics being tried this year, as we reported a few days ago.
Battlefield. I just wanted to say it.
You know, the tradition in campaigns is you spend all summer raising money, and then in the fall you spend most of it on television advertising, at least in Texas. And this summer, a few campaigns are actually spending money to reach voters. Greg Abbott is in movie theaters, which, as we learned from the comments on my story, people are not happy about.
Well, the commenters, anyway.
Yeah.
And is it just in front of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes?
No, they were doing it in...
That's a great movie, by the way. Everyone, go out and see it.
In the theaters that they were doing, I think they were doing it in most of the screenings for every film. It was a little 30-second short ad that has Abbott in a theater talking in his own movie theater. Everyone's watching the movie, and he's looking at a camera and talking about how...
And being incredibly rude.
Talking about how hard it is to make a movie, but it's also hard to run a state, and he's ready to do it. And then asking people to text, I think the word freedom, to some number, and they'll get campaign updates, which when I talked to some experts about, you know, what is Abbott doing, since most people aren't going to remember this ad.
Building a list.
Right. It's to build his donor base and to build his... base of supporters that he can reach out to when it gets closer to election day.
Were people griping because they were partisans, or were they griping because they don't want to see politics stuff in movies?
I think it was a little both. And I got some emails from people too, just horrified at the idea of going to a movie to relax and then seeing an ad.
But, you know, it's weird.
About a political ad.
Can people not relax? You know, you see objectionable things in movies all the time. I don't think that you can't get through a short political ad without getting too worked up.
How come no one's done this before?
Email them back.
It seems like an obvious strategy. Like, why was it? Has anyone done that before?
There have been some campaigns that have advertised in theaters, but it's been very small around the country. There hasn't been a lot of it done.
It's not a great place to advertise for action. Like, you know, hey, go vote because you're about to watch a movie. You know, so I mean, it sort of combines the modern technology. Mm-hmm. You know, the action is sign up for this thing and get on our list so that when it is time to text you,
right?
You know,
but you're reaching
those people
that
again
you
at their phone in November, and they'll say, "Hey, go vote."
Mm-hmm. I mean, and people are sort of forced to sit there and watch the 30-second ad. They can't change the channel.
You can study their milk duds.
No, but it is. You have a captive audience in the way that, like, if you see, you know, every time I try to watch a YouTube video these days, I get a Dan Patrick ad, and usually after the 5 seconds, it gives you the option to skip it. And this is, you know, I would do this for any politician, but I hit skip as soon as possible.
So if you're a politician, in the first 5 seconds, say your name and vote for me.
But you do have, I mean, even if they're uncomfortable and enraged, they still have to sit there.
Mm-hmm. And watch the whole thing, and you know who the person's name now if you didn't before.
But actually, the Abbott's call to action to text or tweet or whatever in his ad that was running in sort of conventional movie theaters did prompt this sort of response PSA from the Alamo Drafthouse, which is, you know, Austin's favorite movie theater chain and probably
right. And they're famous for really they're fast. Famous for these shut up commercials at the beginning of movies that, you know, tell you not to text or talk during the movie. And so they took off on the Abbott movie.
And they said basically like this guy's in a movie theater talking, telling you to text.
Well, what's interesting is it's a
please ignore him.
Abbott's ad is 30 seconds and Alamo runs the first 15 seconds of it before interrupting him and saying, don't listen to this guy. We'll kick you out if you.
Yeah, it's kind of
great for Abbott.
Media for him, yeah.
Well, and Wendy Davis had a really funny response. She tweeted that, you know, I spoke nonstop for 11 hours, but even I know not to talk in the theaters.
It's a really funny response.
So I guess, you know, I guess one of the things that you have to calculate when you're doing these things is do you make as many people happy as mad?
Yes,
right?
You don't want to
be doing your own negative advertising. Oh, that's that theater guy. You know, so we'll see.
Yeah, I can't imagine coming out of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which was
can't
great.
Even imagine saying like the title of it. Yeah.
And just thinking like, oh, but if only it weren't for that political ad before it started, this would have been a great day.
But you know, I saw another political ad. Like, this is the first time I've heard of this happening in during trailers and movies. And the other one I saw was for that Glenn Beck movie. Was it the Glenn Beck, the one about the Common Core and?
Well, that was a trailer for a movie, though.
Right, that's a movie trailer.
Yeah, but it was like a very political movie.
Well, I think probably, you know, the Michael Moore movies, when those were out, I guess you saw the trailers for those.
Yeah, it's so rare that I've seen that in a theater. I guess it is kind of you've got to make a calculation.
That's always how I judge the movie I'm about to see. It's like, you know, they show you certain trailers and you go, wow, so if I'm seeing this movie, I'm in the demographic for that. Yeah. why am I watching Terminators again?
is Abbott's opponent, Wendy Davis, even up on TV yet? Let alone in movie theaters?
No, she's not up on TV, and neither is Battleground Texas, and she's not expected to until probably around Labor Day is when it's expected to start, and when you're expected to really hate television for the next 3 months.
You know, it's really early for the ads to start. They, you know, they typically start around, you know, everybody likes to say after Labor Day. It's, you know, after kids are back in school, people have stopped vacationing, you start turning your attention to these things. Abbott's in a sweet spot because of his money. He's got $35 million, $36 million in the bank, which is probably enough to do this. and he could advertise wall-to-wall on TV in Texas through Election Day now if he wanted to, if that's all he spent that money on. So, you know, they have the luxury of doing that. There are also a bunch of tinkerers in that campaign. You know, Dave Carney and some other people like that who like, you know, messing around with ideas like this. You know, what if you put a thing up on TV and did the text thing? What would that do?
A lot of these guys were involved in the Perry gubernatorial campaign where they didn't do yard signs.
Right, right.
Yeah, 2006.
With that.
So, there's some tinkering going on here. They've got, they're not cash strapped. They don't have to make a lot of decisions about, you know, we can't do this if we do that. They can kind of do everything.
But if you're the underdog in a, you know, state where basically no one has been able to move the needle for your party by doing the conventional campaign for the last couple decades, is doing a conventional campaign and sort of doing ads when you're supposed to do ads and that sort of thing. Is that really a good plan, especially when the other guy is going ahead and experimenting and doing all sorts of different things?
It may be that, you know, this may be one of those cases where the conventional wisdom is right. I mean, it's been tested a lot. A lot of people in politics, you know, think that an ad in the summer is wasted. You know, you're not at the decision point that the voters aren't thinking about it. They don't want to be thinking about it. It's not time yet. And the Davis campaign, I got to say, you know, Abbott has a ton of money. Davis has raised a lot of money. And you know, winning or losing this race doesn't look like it's going to be a financial proposition.
You know, Mike Collier is Democrat running for comptroller. He, as I mentioned in the story, he has run some ads on broadcast television in a few markets for like a couple weeks at a time in Houston, San Antonio, and Austin. And his campaign said they did it because they just kind of wanted to boost his name ID and kind of get people thinking about the race. And they claim that it's helped them in those markets. And, you know, I talked to some experts who kind of said that what he really might be doing is trying to convey to donors and activists that he's a serious candidate and that, you know, he's willing to invest energy and time into this campaign, and you should not just be focused completely on the top of the ticket.
He's TV's Mike Collier.
Right.
well, let's move from politics to policy, shall we?
Absolutely.
Specifically water policy.
Oh, that's not political.
Not at all. No.
Battleground there.
Yeah, the battlefield of water. We were talking about sort of, you know, unconventional tactics and campaigns. What can you tell us about unconventional tactics and evaporation suppression?
Well, campaigns.
Well, once again,
one of your worst sayings ever.
Once again, Wichita Falls is sort of being watched by all of Texas, at least water planners and water officials who are hoping that this might actually work.
What is this?
The basic issue is that evaporation is a huge source of water loss for the world, really, but especially for Texas, which is particularly hot and dry. We lost 2 trillion gallons of water to evaporation in the state last year.
What's normal?
What do you mean, what's normal?
I mean,
Ross isn't asking about water. He's just in general.
It may be in a regular year you lose $2 trillion. I mean, what's the...
Yes, it might be. That's certainly true. Yeah. I mean, last year was not a particularly hot year. We probably lost way more water in 2011, which was the, you know, crazy hot summer. So,
We'd like to keep more water on the ground than we have at the moment.
Exactly. No, and the idea is that that $2 trillion is probably not the most abnormal number. It might be more than previous years because it's still generally hotter than it was 20 years ago. But yeah, this is always an issue. We didn't really care about it before there was a drought. Now there's a drought and we care about it and we're thinking about the drought continuing and future droughts. So how do you stop this from happening? It's really a very simple solution. You just put something between the water and the atmosphere. It's really not that scientific.
Back on the jar.
You know, really, yeah. So as I said in my story, you know, we've heard about people putting ping pong balls all over a reservoir. We've heard about people trying a giant piece of tarp, plastic film. You know, all of these things would work so much for boating.
How do the ping pong balls work?
You just cover it in ping pong balls. You just,
they,
you know,
float,
you
they
just
float,
dump
Reef.
Them all and they float.
And so they form,
as you can actually
so they
see
form
in a
sort of an
nice
effective
artistic rendering
evaporation shield over the light.
Well, that sounds like a ton of fun.
That sounds really? Sounds like a very, very creative ping pong ball manufacturer who kind of overshot sales.
Well, and you could get different.
Maybe we could cover a lake with these.
You could get different color ping pong balls.
Yeah, that sounds like an art installation.
Really, honestly, yeah. It's just that, you know, if people live there, they may not really like that much, and they can't really get their boats out, although they can anyway on Wichita Falls. So, you know. Mm-hmm. Trade-off.
So what are they doing in Wichita Falls?
So
they're not opting for ping pong balls.
No, they're not. What they're doing is they're using a powder-like substance, which is actually pretty unusual even in the world of evaporation suppressants, as I've learned.
Wow, we should start our
this is really my
specialty
job.
Magazine.
Oh, it would get lots of subscribers.
Today on evaporation suppressants.
So it's a powder. And it's 90% basically lime-based powder. It's food grade lime. You can, you know, you wouldn't die if you drank
you could
this
eat
water.
It. Yeah.
Yeah, you could eat it. It wouldn't taste good, but you know, it's edible. And then the other 10% is an alcohol that's extracted from palm oil. So it's really what does the trick is the oil extract, because that's kind of like this little sort of film that will float right below the surface of the water and right. serve as that barrier. The powder, supposedly, according to this company, Flexible Solutions, which makes this product called Water Saver, cleverly named, what the company says is that this powder is made of these different ions that are all the same charge, and so they'll repel each other. They're like little magnets, and they'll all sort of – they don't want to hang out together. They want to kind of – spread out.
Mm-hmm. It's like us here.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, totally. So that's kind of that's the idea. And the reason that that's important is that the reason most people haven't used evaporation suppressants is because it gets windy. So if you have a bunch of, you know, little palm oil extract or whatever it is on your lake and then the wind blows, it'll all blow to one side of the lake and you don't have evaporation suppressant on most of your water and then you've got to reapply it and, you know, it's
this
just a pain.
The obvious problem with the ping pong ball model.
Well, so actually the ping pong ball model, I mean, if you totally cover the lake in ping pong balls, they don't really have any, like, it'd have to get pretty windy. Like, maybe it could kind of work. And tarp wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't have an issue. But anyway, palm oil extract, you know, it would sort of blow to one side. So the point is that this powder is supposed to fix that. A lot of people think that's kind of silly and it's a totally bunk argument and it's not going to work. So we'll really have to see, you know, how this goes.
Is there a thing that, some kind of suppressant that has worked? Is there some kind of like a... Up until now, we've used X.
That's the thing. No large reservoirs have ever really used this kind of stuff. I mean, these types of powders and some of the oils have been pretty much used by people who have swimming pools. Because then, you know, it's not that expensive to have to reapply it if it gets windy because, you know, you don't have that big of a swimming pool. But really, from the research that I looked at on this particular product, the biggest lake it's been used on before this one in Lake Arrowhead was like maybe 500 acres or something. And Lake Arrowhead is right now 5,500 acres.
What do you call someone from Wichita Falls? Wichita Fallian?
Faller?
Fallite? Are they at all concerned about people just pouring
dry
tons of powder into their water?
I think there was some concern about that, because what they actually have to do is this powder biodegrades in the water, so they have to reapply it every 3 days.
3 days? Wow.
Every 3 days they're going
to
reapply.
Must be terrible to have that contract. So
are they drinking this water?
Very potable.
They are drinking this water. They don't drink it right out of the lake. And the water treatment plant, you know, let's hope.
They're running through the water treatment plant where they're treating wastewater.
So actually,
the earlier
thing
that they were alarmed about.
The water treatment plant can... You know, there's pretty good evidence that the water treatment plant can handle it. I mean, the, you know, Texas Commission on Environmental Quality has spent a lot of time looking at that. I don't think more people – I think more people probably wonder about the impacts on wildlife, on fish in the lake. There just really aren't a lot of studies out there for a lake of this size, you know, how that would impact – you know, fish and other. It seems like, yeah. I mean, it's food grade lime, but
little
you're putting
fish
like
with a little bit of lime,
hundreds of thousands of pounds of this in the water.
Well, and the lake's got to breathe some, right? It cut off the oxygen too, right?
Well, that's one of the concerns.
Right.
That's true. Yeah.
So, is Wichita Falls? They're planning to measure this somehow to see, like, they have a way to tell if it works.
Yeah, and there's a, I mean, there's a pretty good method for measuring water evaporation that's been perfected over the years. And actually, it's the Water Development Board, the state water planning agency, that's going to be doing the official analysis of all this to kind of make it so that, you know, Wichita Falls really wanted to press that point on me that we're not looking at this. It's the state that's looking at this, and they're going to have the right data. So, they've got to monitor the water quality every day. They've been doing that so far. It's only been a few days, so they don't really have any results yet, but. If something goes wrong, you know, they're going to have to kind of stop doing what they're doing right away. But right now, I mean, you know, Lake Arrowhead is 20 – I said it's 5,700 acres. It should be 11 – it should be 15,000. It's a third the size that it normally should be because it's lost so much water.
Wow.
And actually, to even get this boat in the water to dump this powder in there, they had to use a tractor because the boat ramps are, you know, way up out of the water. So they're really in a pretty desperate situation.
Wow. Well, this podcast is about – 100% of what it should be. So let's end it.
That's optimistic.
Yeah. I'm purely in time.
First time for everything.
Battles in Texas so far.
If you have questions or comments or any battle plans you'd like to share, please email them to tripcast@texastribune.org. We'd like to thank Shiny Ribs, as always, for doing our music. And on behalf of Aman, Ross, Nina, and our producer Todd, this is Reeve. Thanks for listening.
Nothing really funny is going on.
That's good. Okay, let's go.